This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. Echoes of history in today's refugee crisis. Pope Francis invokes the darkest chapter of World War II.
Quoting Wiesel, he said, "When human dignity is at stake, national borders do not matter." And this was the Pope's way of saying this refugee and migrant crisis is something that we must all bear the burden and responsibility of.
And later in the program, how religion shaped Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister. Pope Francis made a dramatic visit to the Greek island of Lesbos earlier this week, urging world leaders not to abandon millions of refugees. Lesbos is currently home to more than 2,000 refugees packed into a small camp. The Pope also used the visit to Greece to make an historic apology, something that drew a lone but very loud protester. Christopher White is Vatican correspondent for the independent newspaper, The National Catholic Reporter, and he was there.
This was a trip where the Pope was able to really elevate migration, which is, of course, a signature theme of his papacy. And in a very passionate speech in Cyprus, he went off script and said, "If you look at these facilities that are, you know, covered with fences and barbed wire, they have the appearances of concentration camp. This sort of treatment is happening on our shores." And, you know, he wanted to give a closeness and immediacy to it. And he said every country has the responsibility to say what they can accept and then to do it and to integrate. And he really chided world leaders for passing the responsibilities off to others. He was trying to garner some universal appeal toward this message of accompanying and welcoming and integrating migrants.
Christopher, you were with Pope Francis on this trip. What did you see around you when you visited Lesbos with the Pope?
Lesbos was a really stirring scene. In many respects, it's a better environment there than when Pope Francis visited in 2016. In 2020, arsonists had set fire to the former camp. So what has been rebuilt there is a cleaner, newer facility. It's still temporary shelters for over 2,000 people. And so you saw tons of children on tricycles roaming around dirt-filled streets, basically going about daily lives. And then the Pope arrived, and everyone just flocked to the perimeters of the camp and into the tent where they were going to meet the Pope. And the Pope did something, you know, that he's quite fond of doing. He got out and went and touched the people. We were not expecting this, but as soon as he had pulled into the camp, he got out of his car before he reached the tent and walked for almost an hour along the perimeter of the camp, offering individual greetings, blessing elderly women, really being a pope among the people.
The last time the Pope went to Lesbos, he personally brought back 12 refugees whom he was sponsoring, and I think they were resettled in Italy. Is there a similar gesture this time?
Yes, and not quite as grand and shocking, because no one had any clue that he was going to bring back 12 people on the plane with him. But the Vatican, through the international community of Sant'Egidio, has said that he will be bringing back 12 refugees from Cyprus before the end of the year. And it appears as if they'll be bringing another batch after the start of the year, getting that number closer to 50.
One of the things that struck me about your report was that Pope Francis always uses language in a very careful way, so it was notable that he quoted the Holocaust survivor, the late Elie Wiesel. What point did he make there? Because that was quite powerful.
He quoted Wiesel twice, in fact, and he did so the day after he said our refugee camps look like concentration camps. So this theme seemed very much on his mind. And what he said, quoting Wiesel, he said, "When human dignity is at stake, national borders do not matter." And this was the Pope's way of saying this refugee and migrant crisis is something that we must all bear the burden and responsibility of.
The trip was not entirely about refugees, even though that has become one of the Pope's signature issues. I believe he met the leader of the Greek Orthodox Church. I think they got on rather well, but there was an apology for what?
This is not the first time Pope Francis has apologized to Orthodox Christians, but he did so again in Athens in one of his first speeches there. And he said, look, you know, shamefully in the past, there have been mistakes that have been committed by many Catholics against Orthodox Christians. And, you know, he didn't really drill down into the specifics, but of course, you could look to arguments over real estate or arguments over doctrine or just personal disagreements. But this is something that the Pope was saying. He said, these arguments had nothing to do with Jesus or the gospel, but it was all about worldly power. And he said, this has in fact weakened our communion. And he, on multiple occasions, used the word shameful to describe that.
There was a reference to the Pope being opposed to proselytization. It might surprise some people to hear that the leader of the world's largest Christian denomination is opposed to proselytizing, but I guess what was the point that he was making there?
I think this was the Pope's effort to say, within the Catholic fold, we believe there are all sorts of rites and traditions and flavors. Looking at the Orthodox community, I'm not asking for you to give up your traditions, your heritage. And so I think this was the Pope saying, I respect you. I respect your traditions, and I'm not trying to make you embrace our own.
There was, let us say, a minor incident. I believe there was a rather cranky Greek Orthodox priest who made his presence felt. What happened there?
This was when the Pope was on his way in to meet with the head of the Greek Orthodox Church. An Orthodox priest yelled, Pope Francis, you're a heretic. And he said it on several occasions. And, you know, he was then whisked away by some Greek security guards. It was a moment that got a lot of clicks and attention. But, you know, if you compare it to the last time the Pope visited Athens in 2001, where there were massive protests on the streets and signs saying, Pope John Paul II, you're the Antichrist. One lone priest shouting was not exactly anything compared to those mass protests 20 years ago.
Yeah, okay, so there's the passage of time, Christopher. We also remember the time in the European Parliament when the Reverend Ian Paisley, the hardline Protestant leader in Northern Ireland, screamed at Pope yes. John Paul II, you're an Antichrist. But is it more than just the passage of time? Is there something about Pope Francis that has softened these protests, that has softened this hostility?
I spoke with a number of Orthodox leaders, both in Cyprus and Greece, and one of the things that they kept saying over and over was the Orthodox leadership in France have really found areas to work together in, particularly on environmental concerns and migration. And I think because of that synergy that has been noticeably obvious to both Catholic and Orthodox communities, many Orthodox are just seeing the work that is being done together, and they like this forward momentum. And that relationship, it seems, has softened public opinion around historical disagreements. Perhaps folks are saying these doctrinal divides are something we can deal with later because there's work that can be done together in the present.
That's Christopher White of the independent newspaper, The National Catholic Reporter, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Police in Israel have reopened two cold case murders from more than 30 years ago. They suspect the rabbi of a small ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect of involvement in the deaths of two men who disappeared in Jerusalem in the 1980s. Now, this case has prompted calls to end what's known as ultra-Orthodox autonomy. That's a practice where politicians agree to let the rabbis control their own communities while the police and other regulators step back. Iris Makler reports from Jerusalem.
As well as the new COVID variant, what's transfixing Israel is the case of Rabbi Eliezer Berland. He's the charismatic leader of an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect who's been found guilty of sexual exploitation of women in his Jerusalem congregation and financial exploitation of some of his followers when they fell ill, selling them a cure, that is, blessings, in return for large cash payments. Now murder's been added to that list. Police visited him in prison last month to question him over two killings from 30 years ago, carried out by the so-called modesty police in his cult. They're suspected of killing two young men whom they accused of having affairs. Berland is suspected of directing the crimes. Israeli journalist Anshel Pfeffer has written extensively about the issues this case raises. I'm here to see him because I want to know how it is police are only now investigating, and only after new evidence was unearthed by journalists.
That's a very good question. I think one of the reasons is there are parts of Israel where the police isn't properly deployed or where there isn't any significant comprehensive policing. And one of those parts is the ultra-Orthodox community, which constitutes currently about 13% of the Israeli population. And the reasons for that are, first of all, police doesn't really allocate resources to policing in the ultra-Orthodox areas. There is an active discouragement by the leaders of this community for the police being involved in their matters. And for political reasons, because the ultra-Orthodox community has been most of the time an integral part of the ruling coalitions, then there also wasn't any political backing for significant policing. So they've sort of lived in this kind of inside autonomy.
I'm speaking to you in Jerusalem, where the population, it's something like a third of this city is ultra-Orthodox. Can it really be that they have autonomy over everything that happens? It seems quite strange.
As that community has grown, they're now a bigger chunk of the population of Jerusalem, the population of Israel. So it's more striking. This is an outlier. There are not many murder cases within that community. The daily problem of insufficient policing in that community, I think, is a different kind of hidden criminality when it comes to child abuse, to domestic violence, which exists in all communities, but at least in other communities, there is some level of policing, of enforcement, of social services being involved. But when you're not dealing with one type of criminality or the more prevalent types of crimes, then it'll also be more difficult to deal with something like murder. And I think that's the main reason why it took the police so long, and it took basically the media to investigate. But that's the same thing of previous crimes of Berland. It was the media who brought to light the issues of sexual assault that he was carrying out against followers. The media who published the stories of defrauding vulnerable victims. And in Berland's case, because this is of one sect, one cult, then perhaps at the end these things did come out because people left the sect and people opened up on what they'd seen and what they knew. But when they were happening in a wider community, which there's almost a blanket refusal to allow the police to be in, and at the same time the police isn't really even trying to be there, then these things can happen.
You know, it's interesting because while you're saying murder is rare, I was just thinking of the two latest allegations of sexual assault against two prominent ultra-Orthodox leaders. When your writ doesn't run to a community, many things are enabled.
The issues of sexual harassment and of domestic violence aren't well policed here. It's true of ordinary families, and we know that often it comes out against very respected members and families and so on, and it happens in religious communities as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But in religious communities, as you've seen in Australia, for example, in the Catholic Church, when you have this level of religious standing, which gives people both power and a certain level of immunity, then these things can be perpetrated for decades and decades, and when it comes out, people are shocked and surprised. How did so-and-so, who is such a prominent religious leader, how was he allowed to carry out these things for so long? And how did the community and the hierarchy around him cover up for him?
You argued in the Haaretz newspaper, and then the newspaper put this into an editorial, that what we're seeing is the price that comes from the police not being able to do their job within these communities. Can you talk about that?
Well, the police doesn't really want to do that, because if you are an up-and-coming or a senior officer in the police force, and you know that the government isn't really interested in subjecting a certain part of the community, society, to restrictions or treatment that the rest of society gets, then police have get the same message. And it's true of the way the education system in the ultra-Orthodox community works. It's an education system which doesn't teach most of the basic skills needed for living in a modern world.
Even maths or English?
It's English and it's other types of knowledge, because that's the education the rabbis want. So the government doesn't really try very hard to make sure that the schools in that community does that. The same thing is true of building regulations, buildings less safe. And this was largely to do with the fact that the political system has for so many years been built around this agreement that this community can live their lives as they see fit, as their leaders see fit, and the authorities, whether it be police, be it health, education, building safety, have less of an opportunity to be part. Now it's not an official immunity, but that is what's happening.
That's Israeli journalist Anshul Pfeffer ending that report from Iris Makler in Jerusalem. Finally today, Liberal Prime Minister Robert Menzies, who founded what became Australia's dominant political party, was certainly a committed cold warrior, but he had that velvet voice and a certain affable authority that helped keep him in office for 16 years. Menzies wasn't especially ideological. The roots of his liberalism lay in his Christian faith. Now Dr. David Furse Roberts has written God and Menzies, The Faith That Shaped a Prime Minister and His Nation, and David joined me earlier.
Robert Menzies was born in 1894 to Presbyterian parents, but his father, James Menzies, actually went to a Methodist church in Jeparit because there was no Presbyterian church in that country town. And so Menzies was brought up in a Methodist church growing up as a young boy. And he also went to Wesley College in Melbourne, run by the Methodist church. And so he had that dual Presbyterian Methodist upbringing in his early boyhood.
You point out that by the time that he got to Melbourne University, a very bright scholarship boy, he would be something like a liberal or modernist Protestant. What did that look like at the time, David?
Even before that stage, he was influenced by the theology of Henry Drummond, a Scottish Presbyterian theologian, who took the Christian gospel seriously but interpreted the Bible more in the light of modern science. And so Menzies already had that formative influence. But by the time he went to Melbourne University, he joined the Student Christian Union, which was founded originally by John Mott in the 1890s, but it drifted towards a more liberal Protestantism, and it was more of an ecumenical Protestant group as well that encompassed all kinds of different Protestant denominations as well as Anglicans. It had more of a social gospel theology as time went on.
Menzies does not really seem to be a very judgmental sort of Christian. I think you say he was more attracted to the idea of Jesus as the shepherd rather than Jesus as the judge.
His tradition of Christianity very much emphasized the incarnational doctrine, if you like, of Christianity, where the stress was on the humanity of Jesus. He was still believed to be divine, but the main emphasis was on his human side and his human qualities. And that's what Menzies and his form of Christianity sought to emphasize, the values that Jesus taught and how they were applicable to everyday life.
Yeah, and the other thing that came through in your book, and I wonder, David, how this ultimately shaped Robert Menzies' very kind of moderate politics, was that there was a certain almost communitarian view of religion. It wasn't collectivist, but it was certainly communitarian, an obligation to someone other than self.
His often repeated aphorism was, "We are our brother's keeper," or our sister's keeper, as we'd also say today. And that, of course, stems back to Genesis, where Cain is confronted by God after murdering his younger brother Abel. And Cain says to God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And so it was this ethic that Menzies really took to heart from Christianity. And it meant essentially that one has responsibilities and obligations to their fellow citizen in civil society. And this ethic was foundational to Menzies' understanding of Christianity and also his philosophy of liberalism and conception of civil society as being a polity of individuals interconnected by mutual rights and responsibilities.
There was a very strong movement in the early 20th century that had a lot in common with Menzies' sort of liberal Protestantism. You mentioned it before, the social gospel. It was the movement largely, I think, of Walter Rauschenbusch. But you say Menzies stopped short of being a full-blown social gospeler. Why did he do that?
He shared much in common with the social gospel's emphasis on the transformative effect of Christian values on society, but he stopped short of embracing the social gospel because he believed that it placed too much emphasis on reforming the unjust structures of society rather than beginning with the transformation of the individual heart and soul. And so in that respect, Menzies had more of a position closer to evangelical Protestantism, which was always about the personal conversion of individuals before they had the potential to shape and transform society.
David, let's talk about Menzies' approach to a big problem in Australia for much of the 20th century. It seems odd now, but it was ever present, religious sectarianism, Catholic versus Protestant. Menzies can't have been untouched by this, can he?
Well, indeed he was. He said in his memoirs that he was born in a period of Australian social history where there were great sectarian divisions between Protestants and Catholics. As we alluded to earlier, his parents were staunch Calvinists. There was that, I guess, inbuilt antipathy towards Catholic theology and also Roman Catholicism as a movement amongst Presbyterians such as his family.
Yeah, what did his family say when, as a young member of the state parliament in Victoria, he shared a platform with the Catholic Archbishop Daniel Mannix?
Well, they were quite horrified. So they were appalled that he would share a platform with that man, Mannix, in their own words. Menzies stood up to his parents and said, "I'm the representative of all people of all faiths in my electorate, be they Catholic, Protestant, or Brahmins, for all I know," he said.
I'm going to get some people writing to me saying, look, Menzies' later outreach to Catholic voters was really opportunistic. I doubt that it was that simple, but there was, I guess, some political advantage, wouldn't there have been, particularly in the 40s and 50s, in reaching out to Catholic voters?
Yes, there was. I mean, there's two important things to note. The first is that he cultivated warm relations with leaders of the Catholic Church, including Archbishop James Duhigg of Brisbane and Cardinal James Freeman of Sydney. But as well as his favourable policies towards Catholic education, Menzies' earlier appeals to the forgotten people in the early 1940s and also his strong anti-communist stance, that attracted a lot of Catholic support, especially from those conservative small business owners and professionals who made up Australia's middle class. And so in the 1949 election, for example, that attracted quite a large swag of a Catholic vote from Catholics who were concerned about the direction of the Chifley Labor government and concerned about things like bank nationalisation and ongoing petrol and food rationing.
One of the fascinating ironies was that over the years, Menzies did enjoy pretty close relations with many Catholic leaders. In fact, the churchmen that he seemed to have a problem with or conflicts with were Protestants. I think there were a couple of Anglican bishops and then later the Reverend Sir Alan Walker. It was all over the Vietnam War.
Yes, he had some strong disagreements, especially with the Bishop of Canberra, Goulburn, Ernest Bergman, who was a close political ally of H.V. Evatt. And so he held to very different politics from Menzies and also a social gospel theology that, as we established, Menzies did not subscribe to. But also Menzies incurred the ire of Bishop Moyes of Armidale, in the 1960s for his support over the Vietnam War.
Just finally, David, how did religion shape Menzies' temperament?
I think there's a couple of important things to note. The first is that although Menzies had this Scottish Presbyterian Protestant upbringing, he was not what many would describe today as a wowser, in inverted commas.
Yeah, he liked to drink.
He liked to drink. He enjoyed the occasional cigar. He was known to patronise the gentlemen's clubs of Melbourne, and he enjoyed theatre going, and his tastes were not Puritan in that regard. But on the other hand, his lifestyle did reflect deeply held Christian principles, particularly in his aversion to materialism and greed, and also to gambling and just general financial profligacy.
I mean, it's important to remember that Menzies was never a wealthy man, and when he left the prime ministership, I don't think he even had a house to go to. I know that he was given a house later, but I can recall talking to someone who went to the house to visit him frequently, and they said it was a nice house, but it was nothing grand. He was very restrained.
That's right. You know, going right back to his early adult life, he had a very lucrative career at the Melbourne Bar. But he went into politics driven by a deep sense of community service. And all his life, really, as a politician, he never really made a huge amount of money. And so when he retired in 1966, he did not have a really large nest egg of resources to draw on.
Yeah. David, in the end, what traces are left of Menzies' religious worldview in the modern Liberal Party, but even more broadly in Australian political culture?
Well, that's a great question, Andrew, because I discuss in detail the early Christian foundations of the Liberal Party, and it's important just to point out to your listeners that the Liberal Party was never founded as a confessional Christian party or as a political arm of any church. It was founded as a secular party that would be open to people of all faiths or none. But that said, it did have very strong Christian foundations in its emphasis on the inherent dignity and freedom of the human individual, the importance of family and community, of neighbourliness, the protection of the poor and the weak, and of class harmony and cooperation between employer and employee. Now, that resonated both with traditional Protestant values and also Catholic social teaching. It's where they both intersected. And so the Liberal Party has drawn from this rich heritage. And, of course, in more recent decades, it has become more secularised and it's faded more into the background.
Dr. David Firth-Roberts, he's a research associate at the Menzies Research Centre. And David's new book is God and Menzies, The Faith That Shaped a Prime Minister and His Nation. Thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report, David.
A great pleasure to be with you, Andrew.
Now, one place where religion is very controversial in politics is in Brazil, and Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right president, has just appointed one of his key allies, a former justice minister who is what he calls terribly evangelical, to a seat on the Supreme Court. We'll keep a close eye on it. Well, thanks to Hong Jiang and Bryce Halliday. That's the program for this week. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.